is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And Michael Condon here with Emily Doak, and we're in the main street of Holbrook, and we've come here because we wanted to sort of talk about some of the seasonal conditions, Emily, because things in this area and around this area haven't been the best for quite some time, really.
That's right. Producers in this area have been experiencing dry seasonal conditions for going on 15 months to 2 years now. And I noticed driving here this morning, you can see that there's been some activity in the paddocks, people making hay and silage and that sort of thing. And there is green grass in the paddocks on the flats, but you don't have to look too far up into the hills to see that things are really drying off. And here we are only at the beginning of November after a bobtail spring. So we are seeing those seasonal conditions continue to be dry.
And the figures are not looking great either. We've just seen an uptick. I think the figures came out today, up to 33% of New South Wales are in drought or close to drought. That's up from September, a warmer and drier October. And as you say, we haven't even started into summer yet.
That's right. And the outlook for that is that it's because the spring rainfall hasn't eventuated and temperatures were quite warm during October. And it's the south of the state where we're really seeing those dry conditions take hold, particularly here in the southwest slopes region, the greater Hume Shire and into the Snowy Valley Shire are some of those areas that have slipped back into those drought conditions, Michael.
And where they did get the rain, it wasn't really that useful.
Yes,
in recent times.
And just, you know, not enough to really, I suppose, recover from what was a really dry summer, autumn and winter period.
And we're joined here today by, on the main street of Holbrook, by the Greater Hume Shire Mayor, Lee Parker, who's also a farmer, also been lobbying. I think you've got a busy week ahead of you lobbying as well. Thanks for joining us on the Country Hour.
Thank you for having me. Yes,
yeah.
Thank you.
So the season around here, you know, as we were saying, over 12 months for some people have some people have been really struggling for over 12 months, 15 months of low rainfall, and it is starting to tell on the town.
Oh, absolutely. And the whole Shire, to be honest with you. It's not just the farmers that are affected. It's our small businesses. And, I mean, yes, Holbrook's busy, but it's usually, you know, travellers that are stopping on, you know, at lunchtime. Yeah, look, we've only just hit our 300 mil mark on our property, which is 3K south of Holbrook, which is less than half of our annual rainfall in 10 months. So it's been extremely tough. And yes, I have been lobbying very, very hard, and I can proudly report that I'm going to have a meeting with the Premier on the 19th of November.
Yes, I understand that, and facilitated by Independent member Joe McGurr as well, I understand too.
Yeah, he's been fantastic. You know, we have had meetings with David Littleproud, Julie Collins, Minister Moriarty, Michael McCormack, Susan Lee, Justin Clancy. Yeah, but this is probably the most important one, because if we don't get an answer or some kind of action from the Premier, we're in a bit of trouble, to be perfectly honest.
So what are you going to be telling him about the impact of this lack of rainfall and the dry seasonal conditions on farm production in this region?
I think I'll be having a fairly firm conversation with him about, you know, it hasn't rained, Premier. You were down here in August and you said we'll wait for that next rain event. Well, it hasn't rained, you know, and things are getting dire. And it's not just you know, the production side of it. We're also going to be faced with some significant issues with water, you know, moving into summer. And I don't think that the city people quite understand, you know, where we're at. And I think they also need to, I suppose, value what we do down here. Just because we're in the southern parts of New South Wales doesn't mean that we don't matter.
You think you've been a bit forgotten, maybe, in the talk about drought assistance is always, we're hearing always, oh, we're going to get resilience funding and, you know, those sorts of things, that doesn't really cut it when you're facing the dry times that you guys have.
Oh, absolutely. And when I had my meeting with Minister Moriarty, I said to her, to be perfectly honest with you, Minister, we are resilient. We wouldn't be still on the land if we weren't resilient, Minister. You know, we don't need any more training about being better farmers. We are good managers. We can't make it rain. So, you know, your drought hubs and so forth are a waste of taxpayers' money. We need on-the-ground support. And, you know, we gave her some suggestions. The RIC loans, reinstatement of the RIC loans at a 0% for, you know, 2 years, and then another, you know, 3 years at 2% would be gratefully appreciated, but not just for the farmers, but also for the region, you know, for investment like that. It gives the farmers the confidence to go out and buy that new tractor or that new piece of machinery that they've been using for the last 2 years, non-stop. And it does put back into the community and to the economy, and that's really important.
Mm. And people saying, you know, that the rates that are being offered in terms of the lower interest loans are pretty comparable with what the banks are, so there's no real incentive, there's no real difference, no real assistance, really.
Not at all. They're 5.18 at the moment. And look, if you have a good relationship, I was told a long time ago you have to have three things when you're going into a drought: a good mind, a good bank balance, and a good relationship with your bank manager. Now, you know, I'm sure that most of our bank managers are pretty understanding of what we're in at the moment, but you know, I think the bank's offering 5.85 at the moment. Mm. You know, well, that's what my bank manager said. So, you know, why would we want to go through all that process, which they say that only takes, I think, 40 minutes to do the application online, which is absolute farcical, to be honest with you. why would we bother doing that? Why wouldn't we pick up the phone and go to our bank and, you know, have that? We've already got that relationship already established.
So when's the meeting with the Premier, and who do you think's going to be there having a bit of a yarn?
So Mayor Julia Hamm from Snowy Valleys, Mayor Dallas Tout from Wagga City, myself and Joe McGurr, and just just the four of us, to be honest. And and then, so 19th of November at 4:30 in the afternoon, and we'll be having frank conversations because he needs to start doing something. He needs to go to Treasury. He probably needs to go to the Prime Minister, to be perfectly honest, and say, hey, this is your
assistance.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Recognise it as a natural disaster, as it once was, and treat it accordingly.
Well, good luck with that, and we'll also keep a tabs of how that goes as well. So we'll,
yes, absolutely. I'm happy to
let us know what's happening with that as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to Greater Hume.
No, thank you. Thank you for being here. It's the Country Hour's broadcasting today from the main street of Holbrook. It's coming up to 12 minutes past 12.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Now, talking about drought conditions and what's been happening on the ground to the farmers, we're actually joined, Emily, here by a few farmers at the moment. Let's have a bit of a chat to how things are going.
Yeah, that's right, Michael. And we'll start, I suppose, taking a look at some of the impacts of that reduced rainfall on livestock operations. Mary Hoodless, you're a beef producer from the Gingellic region. Just how has your farm been affected by these dry conditions over the past couple of years?
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Rural ABC for coming to Holbrook and for us to have the opportunity to share our story. We've had a really tough 18 months with very little spring last year, no autumn rainfall and very low rainfall through winter, and we're down, but it's similar to what Lee is, 40 to 50% in our annual rainfall year to date. That has meant that many have had to destock. So therefore, even though we've got good prices, livestock prices at the moment, don't have the stock to sell. The feeding out through the winter has just been endless, 7 days a week, every day. And that's resulted in fatigue, also injury, illness. There's been animal welfare issues, you know, because trying to keep animals in good condition to actually calve them down, and now trying to have the fertility rates up to for them to actually get back in calf for next year. And a lot of them aren't going to get back in calf. Today we've offloaded a lot of heifers because we haven't been able to. We just know that it's not worth putting them back with a bull to get them in calf because they're not going to do well.
And I suppose you saw a lot of empty hay sheds, silage pits dug up where you'd been storing silage for a long time. But this spring hasn't been great for fodder production, has it?
No, it hasn't. And we were hoping to get some reserves back, but our spring, the way it's been, we'll be using all those reserves that we've made, a small amount of fodder that we've made. In amongst that, our fodder, particularly our silage, was attacked by corellas, and that meant that we had to get that silage buried. We will be, digging that up, I would expect, by January at the current rate to feed the weaners and also the low amount of water. Our streams and our catchment is the Murray River catchment. That in turn impacts the whole of the Murray basin, and the streams are low. They're that low that you can walk over. Our dams are very low, and the challenge for us is that how we're going to have the, have we got the water going forward to manage the summer ahead? And in amongst that is our bushfire dam danger. We're at really high bushfire danger. Most people know our area was highly impacted in the 1920 bushfires. We ourselves were burned out. The only area that wasn't was our home, and we're facing a significant fire danger because the fuel in the bush now is drier than what it was between the, before the 1920 bushfires. So that fear in front of us, with very little water and very little water supply in the bush or reserves in the bush, is very concerning and quite frightening.
We might come back to you to expand on that a bit further, but let's take a look at cropping now and heading well west of Holbrook. Isaac Muller, you're based at Olmer Park and you're a largely grain producer. Just, you know, how big is your operation?
We've got about 2,600 hectares at Olmer Park, just west of here. And, you know, we had a really late start to the season. And to be honest, like, we were able to produce some reasonable size crops, considering how late our break was. However, you know, with that, with those warmer conditions through the back end of September and October, our yield potential certainly capped off now, and we've had to make some pretty hard decisions over the last 3 weeks as to what we do with some grain crops, and we've cut a fair few of those, which we do most years if the economics don't stack up, and you know, we supply a hell of a lot of this region with our hay and our grain, and it's very hard hearing the stories of those, you know, buying probably hay off us and the challenges they're facing. You know, I probably consider myself lucky considering the amount of, you know, heartache that everyone else is going through. And look, we're struggling. We didn't make a win last year at all. You know, we made a fairly significant loss, and this year's going to be, you know, break even at best, I think. But at the same time, we're just pushing to make these tiny little margins without the help, you know, and our expenditure, our costings per hectare are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Our machinery turnovers more and more significant, and we're still getting the same price for our grain as we were 20 years ago. And the head has gone from 900 to 1.8 million, you know. It's very tough.
So just how much of your crop did you cut that you were hoping to take through to grain but have decided to cut your losses, I suppose, and turn it into hay?
Yeah, so we cut about 600 hectares total. 250 of that was already planned as oat and hay supply for our dairy farmers. But, you know, we made a hell of a lot of hay last year. We did 15,000 big squares last year, so, you know, 10,000 tonne, and we'll probably do that again this year. You know, leading into the harvest period, we'll do a hell of a lot of straw as well for clients just to fill a gap for them going through to April. It comes at a cost, you know, with our paddocks then drying off, but at the same time, that's probably the only way we can get through. You got to love the hay process. It's a big process. It's a hard working process and an expensive process. But if you do it right, you know, it can be, you know, quite rewarding. So, and it come off the truck, you know, and the cattle eating it as it's coming off the truck, or the sheep eating it coming off the truck. But yeah, it's pretty tough.
And Isaac, we're talking about assistance measures. What would make a difference? So you're just sort of hanging on, you say, instead of, you know, breaking even or maybe a loss. And on a big expenditure, what would make a difference for you? What should the government or federal government or, you know, assistance would help for you?
Well, I guess probably our two biggest costs are our, you know, we're an expanding business ourselves, so our biggest cost is probably our interest on our loan. So that's one thing probably out of the control of assistance from the government. But our fertiliser, and that's probably our main expenditure. And, you know, paying $1,500 for MAP and $1,000 for urea is... It's crazy considering our grain prices are still, like I said, the same as they were 20 years ago. But that's probably our major ones, is our cost of production. You know, where everyone says inflation's going and they want wage increases based on inflation and all this sort of stuff. But where's our grain, you know, return based on inflation? Where's our 2 or 3% per year? It's not there.
But with disaster assistance, though, they do have grants and they also do have low interest. And we heard from the mayor saying we should, you know, a 0% loan in disaster occasions. Would that help?
Yeah, it certainly would. It would a little bit. The complexities of everyone's business, it sometimes suits and sometimes doesn't. I think And there's always loops that you've got to jump through. You know, if we've got a diverse business, which we've got other sectors to our business, you know, trying to get assistance just for our farming sector isn't always that smooth line to get through, streamline to get through, should I say. So, yeah, it would help, certainly, and hearing from other people, it certainly would make a hell of a difference, particularly probably further east of us. Yeah.
Well, let's bring in Bruce here now about the situation at your place, Bruce Dwerry House at Gerogery. First of all, I know that you've been involved in the assistance side in the past. We'll talk about that in a sec. But how's the season looking at your place?
Well, look, pretty much the same as what everyone said. Our property's about 40 k's southwest of Holbrook here. It's generally about a 27, 28-inch rainfall area. The last couple of years, we've had about 12 inches or thereabouts. And, look, we had a really good 21-22 with cattle proceeds, and the season was good. All the stars had aligned. But we went into 24 following an enormous slump in cattle prices as a result of a very poor BOM forecast, resulting, you know, in a lot of cattle being pushed onto the market. We then went into 24, had a failed autumn, failed spring, very, very hot summer. 25 was very, very similar, and failed autumn. A winter that was very cold, got some encouraging rains in August, nothing in September, very little in October until the end of October, and then another fall thereafter. Like we had, in the last 3 or 4 weeks, we've had a fall of 3 millimetres and another fall of 18. And to the uninitiated, the country looks great. Mm. You know, it's green, there's people cutting silage, there's a bit of hay cut, but the reality is there's absolutely no subsoil moisture.
Yeah.
And as everyone else here has said, there's a distinct lack of water, and water is going to be a huge issue, which is, of course, going to give us a fire problem as well.
And it won't take many more days of 40 degrees before there's no moisture at all.
No. Well, we've been very fortunate that the weather has been cool, and it has kept the grass growing to some extent. But the biggest issue is that in our situation and a lot of others, we sold all our surplus cattle in the last year. So we had a pretty good income year last year, but it has more than all gone back in, and the lack of funding has meant that we've had to buy a lot of fodder. We've gone through 4 hay sheds. We've bought about 10 B double loads of hay and so on, and it is very, very financially demanding, and we don't have anything to sell. So it's great to say that cattle prices are good, but at the end of the day, if you haven't got anything to sell, you know, it's not going to help.
And I suppose, this Holbrook region, generally considered to be pretty good country, pretty safe rainfall. You've been here for a while. You know, how do you rate this dry period compared to others you've seen?
Well, look, you know, Holbrook is a very safe and a very productive area. I've been farming for 50 years, and I've got to say, the last 2 years have been the most challenging I have had. And we have gone through all the preparedness and so on, and we are still having issues. Mm. Look, we don't want handouts, but we do want a bit of recognition and a bit of help. And the recognition that you people are giving us today is most appreciated. Thank you very much.
Well, talking about that, I'll just get you to put some headphones on, because we've got a quote from the Minister Moriarty talking about drought preparedness, talking about assistance, and talking about the questions that the issues she's hearing back from farmers. Let's hear a bit of what Tara Moriarty had to say.
I was listening to farmers across the south of the state about the kinds of things that we can be doing to support them through this period. I've also indicated that I'm going to make some improvements to the offering, and I'll certainly be having more to say about that soon.
Are you concerned that 50% of those applications are either being knocked back or withdrawn? Is that part of those improvements to address that?
There's all kinds of circumstances as to why people might withdraw a claim. Individual circumstances can vary based on applications. It's good that there is money going out the door to people who need it. I've got a balance between protecting taxpayer dollars to make sure that we've got a robust process, but we want to make sure that it is getting to the people who need it.
That's the Minister Tara Moriarty talking about drought assistance. Now, Bruce, initial reactions to that?
Well, I'd very much like to know how many people are getting that and to what extent they are, how much they really are getting. But, you know, I was involved for 30-odd years working for an organisation in Victoria that administered drought aid, and we made drought loans, carry-on loans, to primary producers at either low interest, low rates of interest, or negative rate of interest, repayable over 10 years. And it was specific, it was timely, and it was very, very well appreciated. Farming is the backbone of the country, and it has such an influence on everything else. People don't spend when they haven't got the money, and that is the problem. We need some help to spend some money to be able to get going again. And you know, don't put too fine a point on it, that the next 12 months is going to be equally as hard, if not harder, than the last because of lack of liquidity. Now, the banks have probably been very accommodating. They've probably been very good. But as has been mentioned before, these RIC loans at 5.18%, they're certainly not concessional. And our family is in a situation where we are going through a succession plan, and we have had dealings with RIC. And I've got to say, dealing with them was good. It was a good process. It was very slow, very cumbersome. But when we first took the loan out 18 months ago, the interest rate was 4.95%. We were told that the rate would be reviewed every 6 months. It has currently been 5.18% for the last 12 months, and there's been three RBA cuts. Now, what is going on?
You made an interesting point there, talking about assistance, and the minister talked about the need to guarantee those loans. Now, from your experience, how many people, how many farmers in your experience when you were dealing with them for the 30 years, what percentage would have defaulted on those loans? Was it a real risk?
Absolutely none.
Yeah.
These loans were secured. Maybe down the line, second, third mortgages or something similar. And look, we made hundreds and hundreds of them in Victoria under the Rural Finance Corporation. We didn't lose any money at all. Mm. And the reality is that with these RIC loans, it's not costing the government too much because they're borrowing money at probably 3.6 or 4%, and they're lending it out 5.18. So, you know, it's not costing them any money. Look, they will get much, much more back in terms of productivity and so on if they make credit available.
And in terms of the state government loans, you know, there's $250 million in the Drought Ready and Resilient Fund, but we've heard that of the 196 applications, roughly 50% of those have been withdrawn or not approved. You know, as a producer, as someone who's dealt in this area, is it concerning for you to hear that, you know, potentially 50% of those loans aren't being approved?
Well, we used to always get quite a bit of criticism because the loan process was difficult. And I do understand that you've got to go through certain things to do that, but it can be simplified. And in Rick's situation, their process was simplified. It was very good. It was very smooth. Obviously, under the RIA, it is very cumbersome and very low. And, you know, if it wasn't for people like rural councillors and the like, there'd be a whole lot less than 50% that would be approved.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting point about the amount, the percentage that are not getting assistance, the percentage that are the risk there too. And maybe, you know, also the talk about disaster assistance, you know, where the loans can be, if underwritten by the federal government, even less than the market rate. What's your thought about that?
Well, look, the risk is negligible, you know, and it's been proven over a long period of time that the risk is negligible. These things make it work. They make it work. And as I keep saying, we're not looking for handouts, but we want some assistance when it's due. And the fact that they've changed the way they consider drought has been an absolute disaster. We know
this is the New South Wales view of everything.
Yeah, well, and federal. Yep. We know that, you know, it's a variable climate, and every 5 or 6 years you have a very dry year. But you can only prepare so much. Like, we've built new hay sheds, we've upgraded the water, we've got lots of hay and that sort of stuff. But, you know, we're still up against the wall.
And Mary Hoodless, back to you. I suppose just looking at the wider impact of this on the community, as you mentioned, many people were impacted by the black summer fires. We're now seeing these dry conditions. What's your sense of how the community is coping with this?
I think there's a great deal of fear, and if not now, as soon as it they see the country dry, and we know what's what we've faced in the past, and that great fear of a bad day will be, there'll be a heightened level of anxiety on already a stressed community. We've also got properties that are people that have said they've had enough, so there's enormous, you know, more than normal numbers of properties on the market that we've seen, but there are also others that I've been told they've just said we are feeling embarrassed about the, and being known that we actually are for sale because we just can't continue. We don't want more debt, that the current debt, going into more debt to actually buy more fodder to survive is really difficult. And there might be people that have got water, which I know of, that have, people have got, you know, they've invested in good pivot irrigation, but they haven't got the water to actually use it. And the other issue is feral animal, which I haven't mentioned. So we've been inundated with feral animals as a result of the drought, and there's very little feed in the bush. So deer and pigs on our properties and any property that's with national parks or state parks as their boundaries. And this year, we LLS put a lot of effort into a mid-winter cull, which we'd all consented to because it was by an aerial cull. And only a couple of days before, we heard National Parks withdrew from that project. So as soon as the animal got into National Park, they weren't able to deal with it.
Mm. I also wanted to talk to you about the bushfire risk. We touched on it before. Just how bad do you think it is this year? You know, give us a snapshot over, you know, a historical snapshot.
So the history of the Upper Murray is about around about every 30 years, there's a fairly significant fire event. And at the moment, we're only just coming under 6 years since the 1920 bushfires. And
2020
bushfires. Yep. And we are hearing that the fuel and the vegetation, the dry matter, is drier than what it was preceding that time, the Black Summer. That is of great concern to us. But in addition, this year we've got low water as well. So they rely on the dams, they rely on our creeks and our, particularly our dams for water and the river to fight those fires. And without that water, it puts the whole area at extreme risk. So through that fire, there were 600,000 hectares when the Duns Road fire and the Green Valley fire complexes got together and then moved through to the Upper Murray. Thousands ahead of stock, mostly unreported, was impacted, and many people have got very raw memories of that period of time and afterwards. And it was, for many of us, we haven't got our stock numbers back to where they were, so the recovery is still taking place, and now we've got that the risk of that again, but we've had the drought impact on stock numbers as well, so that recovery now has been extended for a longer period than what we anticipated.
Appreciate that. It's good to get a perspective on that. Thanks for joining us on the Country Hour today.
Thank you
to our farmers there who are giving us a bit of a snapshot of the dry conditions here. We'll be talking about the weather in a sec. First of all, let's go to some news headlines with Sally Ann Young.
Thanks, Michael. Some federal Liberal MPs are being accused of causing disunity rather than standing behind their leader. The federal opposition leader, Susan Lee, has this week addressed speculation of a leadership coup, saying she's completely confident she will remain leader. A top Pentagon official has strongly endorsed the AUKUS submarine agreement, saying it's in America's interests. The Pentagon launched a review in June in line with the US president's America First agenda. Since then, Donald Trump has publicly endorsed the $368 billion pact, saying it's going full steam ahead. The New South Wales opposition leader Mark Speakman is holding firm on his support for the net zero emissions target in the face of a potential Nationals revolt. Federal fallout on the issue is having an impact in New South Wales, with the state's Nationals actively considering whether they'll follow the lead of their federal counterparts and dump their support for net zero. Mark Speakman acknowledges some farming communities have wheel-founded concerns, but says he's fully committed to the 2050 target. And HSC exams are nearly over for another year, with around 4,000 students across New South Wales currently sitting their food technology exam, which is due to finish by 5 p.m. Over the last 17 days, around 75,000 students have sat more than 400,000 exams across the state. New courses in geography, software engineering and computing were tested this year, two of which went online for the first time. Results will be out on December 18th. And I'll have more news for you at 1 o'clock.
Okay, white knuckle time for those students as they wait for those results. Thanks,
Sally. Oh, it's a hard time to wait.
That's right. It seems like an eternity. Thank you for that. Let's go to the bomb now, and we'll find out the latest from Juan Park. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
Now, it's warm and sunny here. Bit of cloud in Holbrook, but I think it's about 30 degrees, something like that, here in Holbrook. Is that likely to change? Are we going to see a system come through here?
Yes. Well, we expected Wagga and the Holbrook areas to reach about low 30s maximum today. But as you guessed, we expect a significant drop of temperatures tomorrow into Sunday behind the cold front that will be crossing much of the state, entering the west on Friday and crossing much of the state during the weekend. So just warm conditions today and the temperatures drops tomorrow. Also, something I want to mention is that the temperatures in the farther west will be hotter with maximum temperatures reaching mid to high 30s in places like Broken Hill and Wilcannia and Burke and Coba and so on. And also we also anticipate the fresh northerly winds to develop in the west ahead of this cold front with a maximum mean wind speed of maybe up to 40 kilometers per hour. And also, there is a risk of severe thunderstorms developing about the northern inland today. And then tomorrow will be interesting because as the cold front shifts eastward, the risk of thunderstorms will be also shifting to the northeast quarter and the central eastern areas, where we may see the development of severe thunderstorms mainly during the afternoon and the evening, and the forecast around the Hunter and the mid-north coast areas tomorrow, where we may see damaging winds and large hailstones and localized heavy falls leading to flash flooding, all possible for those districts. And for other parts of the northeast quarter and the central eastern areas, like Sydney, Illawarra, Northern Tablelands, and Northwest Slopes and Plain and Central Tablelands, damaging winds will be the main concern for tomorrow, although there is a secondary risk of large hailstones as well. And also, the winds will be fairly fresh and gusty tomorrow, northwesterly turning southwesterly as the front moves through. And then after this cold front, we expect the temperatures to drop significantly by about 7 to 12 degrees. Maybe on Saturday we may see the temperatures dropping to low to mid-20s in the west and then spreading to the eastern areas by Sunday.
So you talked about some wild weather and some thunderstorm activity and maybe some rainfall and some damaging winds. Where in the state might we see that? What sort of areas should be looking out for that?
Today's watch area will be the northern inland areas, places like Walgett, for example, and maybe possibly extending into Moree. Then tomorrow, main watch area will be even broader, encompassing the whole northeast quarter as well as the central eastern areas. That includes from Illawarra all the way to the northwest slopes and plains. But for tomorrow, as I mentioned, the main focus area will be the Hunter and the mid-north coast, where we may see quite active severe thunderstorms during the afternoon and the evening period tomorrow.
And a fair bit of rain, maybe?
If there's any rainfall, it will be very much localized these severe thunderstorms. But otherwise, we just expect just a few millimeters of rainfall with the showers.
Juan, thanks for that.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It's 22 minutes to 1.
This week on Landline, the menace of feral pigs.
They can take your potential production and halve it. Pigs can do a lot of damage, and they do a lot of damage to country.
That's Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
Well, in other news, another round of proposed cuts to New South Wales state government services has alarmed public servants and environmental advocacy groups. The New South Wales Environment Protection Authority, or EPA, announced it was considering a new operating model designed to save the regulator an estimated $20 million and the cost of over 150 jobs. David Claughton has this report.
This should not be happening, and why we need to be strengthening the EPA and not cutting it in New South Wales.
No hits, no cuts, stop the Indian cuts. No hits, no cuts, stop the Indian cuts. No hits.
Workers from the Public Service Association rallying in Parramatta this week. Julia Ann Bond is the industrial manager at the PSA, and she told Charles Rushforth what she knows about the cuts.
We've been advised that there's a $20 million budget debt for the EPA. Now, the remedy that the EPA and the government are taking in this, which is just unfathomable, is cutting frontline roles. Now, those roles are integral in protecting our state's environment. They're there investigating criminal waste, such as asbestos dumping. They're in ensuring that our waterways are protected. It's those frontline roles that go out and investigate, go out and prosecute, go out and test soils and so on. They will be the ones that will be gone and, again, compromising our environment. We understand that these roles are going to come across from both regional locations and certainly metro locations across the state.
The PSA said it was looking to take further industrial action over the cuts. The EPA is the latest in a series of state government agencies to announce job losses this year, with Transport for New South Wales, TAFE New South Wales and Water New South Wales announcing cuts totalling around 1,400 jobs. The Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development axed 165 positions in August, affecting many facilities around the state, including a laboratory in Wagga Wagga, which will close this month. That lab provides chemical and sensory testing necessary for olive growers to get certified for export. In a statement, a spokesperson for the New South Wales Farmers Association said it was a real worry, and New South Wales biosecurity systems should be a top priority for the state government, and they should resource them appropriately. Minister for Agriculture Tara Moriarty told Marina Trakovic the cuts at DPIRD won't affect services.
I'm confident that the government will be able to deliver the services that we need to be delivering for regional communities. Certainly the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development, which is the department I'm responsible for, is well equipped and well able to deliver the services that are needed for regional communities, for primary industries. We've got to operate within the budgets that we're allocated in. Everyone running a household or a budget understands that that's the case.
Where is that reform process at the moment? Do we have figures for how many people have lost their jobs or how many vacancies that we have at the moment in regards to the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development?
So there's almost 5,000 people in the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development that are based in over 200 locations across New South Wales. There's around 159 that will be impacted as part of this change program out of almost 5,000 people. It's very disappointing for the people who are impacted, but I'm very confident that the department will be able to continue to deliver all of the services that we need across our primary industries and our regional communities.
The CEO of the Nature Conservation Council, Jackie Mumford, said it's a bad time to be cutting staff from the EPA.
It's coming at a time when we have illegal land clearing on the rise. There were 29 breaches made by Forestry Corporation in Talaganda State Forest that were just prosecuted recently.
And she's worried about land clearing as well.
How we manage habitat and biodiversity on private land is a really, really important one. The SLATS data that came out this year showed there'd been a 40% rise in land clearing in the state year on year in 2023. And, you know, a lot of that clearing, we don't actually know what's driving it or whether it's legal or illegal. And so the scale of environmental management in the state is really huge. And I think now is the time for the government to be investing more resources into the EPA, not less.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Environmental Protection Authority said the changes are intended to bolster the organisation's environmental protection capability and they're not targeted at frontline or regional workers. The spokesperson said many of the 182 affected employees will fill 113 vacancies in a proposed new structure. All will be supported to secure roles elsewhere in the New South Wales public service, where possible.
Thanks there to David Claughton for that report, and also interviews by Lauren Bohane, Charles Rushworth and Marino Trakovic. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 16 to 1.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. With more than 3,000 billionaires already, one man is set to become the world's first trillionaire. And speaking of riches, the untold story of Monopoly, the board game turning 90 this year, which was originally invented to teach against greed and capitalism. Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces say they've agreed to a ceasefire, and park rangers on Christmas Island say they're close to a total eradication of feral cats. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
But here on The Country Hour, broadcasting from the main street of Holbrook, we're looking at the seasonal conditions here, and Emily Rotary are stepping up to help out the locals in terms of the seasonal conditions we're seeing here.
That's right. As we've heard from the farmers earlier, you know, this is something that many people have been experiencing for going on 2 years. Kerry Morton is from the Rotary District organisation here. Kerry, what sort of assistance has been provided and how was that secured?
Our Rotary District recognised, made an application to Rotary International, our foundation, which is our charity, for disaster funding, which is something that the foundation supports. They recognise that we're in a disaster situation and they managed to supply $25,000 to help clubs support their local rural areas. Our club at Holbrook were able to secure a $5,000 grant, and we worked with the Rural Financial Counselling Service to assist us to identify those families in the most need.
And in doing that, you're also ensuring that the support that's being provided, that financial assistance, is fed back into the local community by providing by local vouchers.
Absolutely. We're able to do it using IGA vouchers largely. The conditions of those donations were that we shop local, because our IGAs are the ones that hire local people and they support the local economy largely. So we were able to access that way. Also, we got a few fuel vouchers for families, because if you can put fuel in your car, you can afford school shoes. Just to relieve that, on conversations with several farmers in the district, I was able to identify that people aren't buying a full grocery order anymore. They're not filling their pantries up. And if you live out of town, having a stocked pantry is part of a necessity. If you can't fill your grocery basket up, and you're living from week to week, day to day, and just getting the specials at the supermarket, then that's a good indication that people are in dire need.
Aside from a little bit of financial assistance, I suppose, what sort of difference do you think that will make to people to know that other people are thinking of them and providing this sort of support?
Some of the feedback that we've received already was that they are so grateful that somebody recognises that we are in need of assistance on the land, and the recognition that family farms are important and generational sustainability is an important issue to be able to address and hanging on. And so we've received a lot of gratitude for that, which is terrific, and all anonymously, which is terrific. We're very careful not to identify. So using the counselling service, we're able to maintain the privacy of those recipients, and also the feedback's coming back anonymously, so it's more honest. And they're just feeling well supported, so that we're very grateful. We've done our job.
Good things done by Rotary locally here in Holbrook, Michael, to support those drought-affected farmers.
Now, we're getting a few texts too about the situation here. Andrew has texted in to say, of course, we should be helping farmers and farming communities during the dry times, and also perhaps engaging with the science of climate change a bit more might be a bit of a basic minimum expectation. We had another text from someone who was talking about farmers here should be accessing their overdraft to assist like other farmers elsewhere in the state. So a bit of a controversial text coming in. I'm sure that farmers are accessing their, from what we've heard earlier today, Emily, I'm sure that's happening already.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. And we're joined now to talk about Landcare and some of the issues that are happening there. Of course, amazing award that Holbrook Landcare got just recently, the National Bob Hawke Award. Congratulations in regards to that, first of all.
This is Chief Executive of Holbrook Landcare, Alison Southwell. Well done.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're very excited. It's a great honour that really shows a long-term dedication by members in this area to Landcare. And bringing together both production and environment into their businesses.
And I suppose, obviously, your members are experiencing this drought condition. What's been your focus in, I suppose, providing assistance, information and advice to those producers?
Yeah, we cross across three pillars. So we're environment, community, and we're also production agriculture, sustainable agriculture. So I guess we've been trying to hit all three in terms of making sure that we're holding community events to deal, to bring people together and deal with mental health issues. We've also been trying to work hard with the Southern New South Wales Drought Hub and others, local land services, to make sure that we have as many services available and education opportunities available.
Things like containment feeding.
Containment feeding is a big one, farm water, helping people manage their farm water, and particularly around the containment feeding, making sure they understand that it doesn't have to be an expensive, complex setup. You can do it with a hot wire, and making sure that, you know, people see a range of ways of doing it and finding one that works for them.
Excellent. Thanks so much for your time. And one of the other, I suppose, research areas that Holbrook Land Care has been looking at, Michael, is tropical pastures, introducing different types of pastures that can survive in different climates. And with us right now is Neil Turlick, and he's a manager at Scotts Angus, which is at Pleasant Hills, west of Holbrook.
Yes.
What have you been looking at in terms of how these tropical pastures that we'd normally say seen grown in northern New South Wales or Queensland, how they're being used here in southern New South Wales?
Well, Stephen first seen them up north and everyone said they won't grow here, the climate too cold. But with the summer rains we've been getting over the last 8 or 10 years, we've actually been getting more summer rain than winter. We thought we'd give them a go. We sowed 150 hectares in 21 and they've all taken off, and with the rain earlier this week they've already got a 5 centimetre shoot on them, so they grow very well. They go very dormant during the winter. Once your soil temperature sort of gets up around that 15 degrees they seem to take off and they're go very well. So
another sign maybe of climate change, do you think? You were saying that people were poo-pooing the idea, but they seem to be working.
Well, they do seem to be working. Personally, not a big believer in climate change. I think it changes every day as it is, but that's what we talk about a lot, so we'll go with that.
But it's helping you to adapt, I suppose, to make the most of that summer rainfall when, you know, your ryegrass, your clovers would be burnt off in this heat.
Yes, it does. Definitely. The summer rain and the digits have gone hand in hand. They've been fantastic. Great feed during the summer, like if we keep getting the rain at the right times, yeah, it keeps going. But again, we rely on water, rain. If it doesn't rain for a month, it stops growing. Mm. It's pretty simple, a bit like everything. Yeah.
And so what are we talking about here? What's when we're talking about tropical pastures, what are they? What are we talking about? Is there a mix, or are there particular ones that seem to be
we've only sown the what we call the digit grass, which is a subtropical. We found establishing it is the hardest part of the digit. It's preparation for a couple of years before it. Soil temperature, it's got to be above 15 degrees or it won't grow. And competition. So you don't want to sow anything else with it. You just want the digit grass. We still have our clovers and that over the winter. So you still graze the paddocks. But for the summer, and you want the clovers there because they put nitrogen in the soil. Then in the summer, your digit takes it out.
And it does better in the not so great soils, I understand.
It will grow pretty much anywhere, I reckon. But you're right. I know a bloke's got some in some very shaley country not far from Henny, and it's going very well.
Of those sandy soils that may not be so great for cropping.
Yes, and up north as we've had blokes come and talk about it, that in the sandy soils up there where it hadn't rained for 2 or 3 years, and then all of a sudden they get a storm, and within a week it's a foot high. It just comes from nowhere. You don't even know it's there, and it just, it comes away. So I think it can be grown around here, and I think it should be practiced a lot more, actually. A lot of people use lucerne. A lot of money and work in lucerne to keep it clean and going, but,
One to watch, no doubt.
It is.
To think about in terms of the warmer weather as well. Appreciate your time on the Country Hour today.
Thank you.
It's coming up to 7 minutes to 1.
Each weekday at noon,
we created the first IVF kangaroo egg.
Tune into the Country Hour.
Grow a variety of different garlics.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
It is better to be safe than sorry.
On ABC Radio.
Well, let's turn our attention away from the cropping and the livestock now. Let's talk, well, we're talking about different sort of livestock, talking about eggs and birds, and Sam Pincock's here talking about the free-range egg production system that he's got going. Starting out small in 2010, really small in 2010, you've expanded a lot.
That's right, Michael. Yeah, 2010 we started with a trial of 50 hens, 50 chooks. And we've grown that to, by the end of the year, will be 36,000 birds on farm.
36,000 in that time. And supplying, like, everywhere?
Supplying majority of over 80% go to Sydney. And the rest, 20%, are in our local region here between Albury, Holbrook and Wagga.
And you did get affected by bird flu or not when the last lot came through?
Well, affected in not in a direct way, right, that our farm was impacted, but the business, I guess, was impacted in that there was a massive shortfall of eggs across the country. So, which is, I guess, was timed purely by chance with our growth. So we've been able to capitalise it in one way.
So you were lucky in a sense.
We were fortunate.
Very
absolutely
fortunate. But not saying that bird flu is a good thing. We don't want to see bird flu in Australia,
not at all.
Of course.
It's obviously been one of our biggest risks from when we started, especially with the nature of how we are producing the eggs. So, we certainly don't like to hear cases in the country.
But swings and roundabouts, there are always going to be some silver linings, I guess.
Absolutely.
Now, so expanding quite a lot, was that a conscious thing? Was it just driven by, you were saying, we'll give this a go, and then it just took off? I mean, was that the plan always from the beginning?
No, it certainly wasn't the plan always from the beginning. I guess we started doing what we were doing on the back of a little bit of adversity through the Millennium Drought and plus the Black Saturday fires down at Yay, where we were farming at the time, which has enabled us to see an opportunity, and it's just grown from there.
Mm. And you were saying, you supply locally as well, but mainly to Sydney. Is there a particular marketing you use that's attractive?
Yeah, I think we've got a very a genuine story that we really promote in how we're producing the eggs. And whilst we hear a lot about the divide between the city and the country and understanding where our food's coming from, we're supplying to a demographic that's very interested in the provenance of their food and where it's coming from. And so our production story fits into that market.
And in fact, you were getting so many requests for people coming to look at on-farm production that you've had to set up a shop front to give people a little bit of an insight here in Holbrook.
Yeah, so just coming up 2 years ago, we opened it's an interactive retail shop where you can come in, you can look through some viewing windows into where we're grading and packing the eggs. So it's just an experience for the public to come and see that. As you say, it was getting harder and harder to have people on farm from a biosecurity point of view. So we've been able to open this space where there's some interactive education that gives everybody an understanding of how we're producing the eggs, how we're farming and running the business.
So,
Agri-tourism.
Agri-tourism.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you had to get that one in there. I was going to say you're killing two birds with one stone, but that was probably the wrong thing to say.
We could go on with the egg puns all day. Yeah.
Excellent. All right, thanks for that.
Terrific.
We'll leave it there. Let's go to markets.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers eased to 7,500. This included 1,650 new season lambs. Most of the lambs now are new season shorn. It was a very mixed yardie in both weight and quality, with some lambs drying off and there wasn't many heavy lambs. After a very strong sale last week, prices were back $4 to $5 on average. New season trades, $222 to $275, and they average $1,120 to $1,130. The heavyweights, $273 to $301, or around 1,100 cents. There was a big run of very light merino lambs, $30 to $74. Shorn trade lambs, $242 to $281, averaging $1,120 to $1,130. Heavyweights, $267 to $316. Extra heavies topped at $394. Trade merinos, $242 to $293, and they averaged $1,060. Mutton numbers lifted to $4,400. Prices were dearer, with mostly medium and heavy weights offered. The medium weight ewes 156 to 192. Heavy crossbred ewes reach 225 and big skin merinos 256 to 280. Most average 700 to 750 cents.
And that's the market information for today and for the week. And Emily, so we're bookending the seasonal conditions here down in the south with what Lara and Amelia were looking at up north, where the harvest is going okay.
Different conditions in different parts
of the
state.
Absolutely, yes. Tale of two cities. It's heading up to news time.